will be on April 16th at 6:30 p.m. for Wednesday night instead of a Tuesday. And at that meeting, Jerry Bunin of the Home Builders Association will be discussing housing policies and strategies that home builders would find beneficial to providing affordable housing. Tonight, we have a guest speaker, Jeanette Duncan, from People's Self-Help Housing Corporation in San Luis Obispo. She'll tell you all about her association when she does her presentation. We'll be in just a moment. I wanted to quickly run through a few of the items that were brought forward at the last few meetings, or last meeting in the time since then, just to kind of let you know what's been discussed so far, and if there's anything new, that's what we'd like to hear tonight. Issues discussed include the consideration of intensifying zoning, perhaps creating a R4 zoning district designation, that would have 30 dwelling units per acre. And this is just a list of ideas. These aren't things that are necessarily going to be incorporated, but these are just ideas that have been brought forward. There would like to be consideration of rezoning property west of Beckett Place from the coastal industrial commercial zone to some type of residential zone or mixed-use development zoning, provision of inclusionary housing, density bonuses. There's a lot of concern regarding planned unit developments in the community that perhaps the city should consider modifying development standards to make them less dense and provide enough parking. There was the idea of providing manufactured home parks as another alternative for affordable housing. Another idea brought forward is to reduce parking. Another issue that was brought forward and that we're actually mandated to update in our zoning ordinance has to do with second dwelling units or granny units. This person, for one, would like to change the nomenclature of granny units to something else. And also perhaps look at modifying our standards so that we can have detached second dwelling units and allow them perhaps in other districts. We are required to change the review process, which I think we discussed at the other meeting, but just for the public to understand, so that it's not a discretionary review process, but is actually a ministerial process that's basically reviewed by staff. Also, there's concern regarding modifying the standards for second-story homes in areas that have ocean views. That will be considered as part of the standards and potential impacts to providing affordable housing. Those are the issues today. I'd like to introduce Jeanette Duncan.
I've been told that it's all set up and ready to go, and we have a technical expert in the back to help me out in case it doesn't work. I wanted to do a little slide presentation that would, first of all, tell you a little bit more about who we are, People Self-Help Housing, and see if it's going to come up here.
There we go.
And a little bit about who we are, what all we've done, and then show you some pictures of some of the developments that we have with some information about density, because sometimes density can be misleading, we believe density can be a dream that everyone has. I don't know here, Dave, we're kind of going, if it's going to work, you need to get down the lights a little, that's better. We've been around 30 years. We were actually formed and incorporated in 1970, and we've won a lot of awards because of our kind of unique approach to developing housing for low-income and special needs households. And the other thing we do is do what we're doing tonight, which is provide some technical assistance in the design and implementation of affordable housing. We have a wide range of housing that we do, rental, home ownership. I think some of you know we do the sweat equity home ownership program called Mutual Self-Help. We do mixed use housing and commercial, and then we do a lot of support services and include them in all our developments, daycare, health facilities, and classrooms, and a lot of educational opportunities for people living in our housing. When we started in 1970, we started with a $2,000 loan from a local church. It was actually the Methodist church up near Cal Poly. And then we got a grant from a division of the Department of Agriculture. It was called Farmers Home Administration to start our self-help housing mutual building program. And we moved into rental development and property management in 1989. And we opened our second office in Santa Barbara in 1996, primarily because Santa Barbara was experiencing such a high rise in housing costs, and they were desperate. So they asked us to come down and open up an office there. We've helped almost 1,000 families build their very first home, where we've acquired the land and put in all the streets, utilities, and supervised construction. And we now have over 1,000 rental units we've developed. And in all our rental housing, we have enrichment programs for our residents. And so looking at where we're working today, we have rental properties all the way north as far as Paso. And we have things in construction in Piru near Magic Mountain in Ventura County. So we're pretty stretched out. We have the self-help home ownership program that I mentioned, where people are building their own homes. We do community development, working with groups such as planning commissions and boards of supervisors and neighborhood groups. We also have a new division called Health and Community Services, because we discovered that so many of the people living in our affordable rental housing don't know a lot about preventive health care, and they're ending up in the emergency rooms, or they're ending up with all kinds of problems that are at an advanced stage, particularly asthma and other things. So we now have a health component. We did a demonstration program down in Carpinteria. We got some funding from the California Endowment and included health screening in our community center there. And of course, we do all the rental housing development, where we're acquiring the land and putting the financing together. And then we manage our own properties, so we have a full property management staff. And about 7 years ago, we decided, since we'd built all these single-family homes, we could also build our own multifamily. So now we're building all our apartment complexes as well. And community development, that's kind of what we're doing tonight, where we give technical assistance to the city and county governments about housing policy, project development, and also we manage grants. Someone helped me bring the equipment here tonight, and he said, gosh, I haven't been here since we helped the city do a rehab program back in like 1990. And so we did get some block grant money for the city, and we made some loans to families here to put on a new roof or to fix up their house. And we also look at some long-range planning, and that's what you're doing here. You're looking at a five-year plan on the housing element. Isn't that right, Sue? 7 years? Okay, so that's pretty long. In rental housing, that's where we put together all the funding sources to build the apartments, and then we actually do the construction. We also do rehabilitation of existing rental housing that we're going to acquire and rehab. And by the way, that picture there is a shot of Coelty Court, which is on Elm Street. So if you go up Arroyo Grande to Elm Street and you hang a right, and you go up about a block, two blocks on the left-hand side, is Coelty Court. That's a development for seniors that we did, and we finished that about 6 years ago. And our partner in this is Southern California Edison, because we use financing, tax credit financing, and they're our partner. In construction, we're building all our own apartment complexes and community buildings and commercial spaces. And as far as property management, now Oak Forest, you may recognize that, because that's also on Elm Street. When you go up Grand and take a right on Elm, you don't go very far, and right on the left, area for farm workers called Las Adobes de Maria. And as far as property management, we really we have a pretty large portfolio. When you look at the value of all our rental properties, we have 27 complexes. So you have to take care of those and also monitor all the regulations for the funding that we get. And then we have our staff living there, and their responsibility is to build community. And then as far as who we're serving in rental housing, it's special needs households. By that I mean we have fragile people who've maybe had health, mental health problems. We have families. We're working with seniors, physically disabled as well as developmentally disabled. We have a pretty broad range of cultures that we work with, and we also work with some of the homeless shelters and also the women's shelter, like in San Luis Obispo or in Santa Maria. And then in health and community services, as I said, we really provide now opportunity for our residents to have health services. This is a clinic we did in Carpinteria with our first grant from the California Endowment. And what we do is we build all the health screening facilities, and then different providers come in. Public health will come in and run a clinic. We'll have a well baby clinic. We have women's health classes and health exams. We don't staff the clinic. We just provide the space free of charge. The same thing with daycare. We build the space and then let daycare providers use it. So some of the services that we have are literacy and arts, after-school tutoring, and as I said, maybe inconsistent zoning. So I thought it would be good to talk about some of the different constraints and also what we run up against in some of the entitlements and approvals, and then just look at housing types. One of the things that's really difficult is to find sites that are either appropriately zoned or have adequate size, and many times we have such low density requirements that you just can't get enough units to make it really pencil out. Or maybe you have land that isn't even zoned non-resident, it's not zoned residential, we need to change the residential zoning. Or maybe there's no zoning for mixed use. Also, when it comes to development standards, as I said, sometimes you're faced with side yard setbacks or open space requirements or minimum square footage for single family lots. One of the things you run into on the urban, you don't have it so much here, but in some jurisdictions right on the urban boundary, you may be up against agriculture, and so you're required to have this ag buffer, which means you have to create these big lots, like 14,000 square feet or quarter acre. And then when it comes to entitlements and approvals, one of the things that's always difficult, whether it's a nonprofit such as ourselves or a regular market rate builder, is when you buy land and you're going to try to build, you don't know how long it's going to take to get entitlements or your building permits. And all the time, this is running up the cash register on costs. And also, impact fees are going up, and this makes it more difficult. And then sometimes you run into trying to do large household housing or farm workers or seniors. So one of the things that we look to do is change zoning or to try to assemble, package several lots, put them together. And one of the things that we're recommending for the coastal area is that under medium density residential zoning, we should have at least 18 dwelling units to the acre. And ideally, high-density zoning should allow at least 30 units to the acre. And then, as I heard, you are going to formalize your density bonus program. So that's, we commend you for that, because that's going to help a lot, too. And then really use any public resources that you might have in the way of city-owned land or school-owned properties. And these are some examples of what we've done. We completed this in 1991. It's for elderly in the city of Paso Robles. It's a three-story building with an elevator, but the actual units per acre is 36. So it's pretty high density, but it's attractive from the street. It's in a redevelopment area of the city of Paso, and we did use some of the redevelopment agency funding. In Templeton, we did something unique. I don't know how many of you have been up to Templeton, but if you get off at the Las Tablas exit and you go west, there's the Twin Cities Hospital. Do you know where that is? Well, if you could envision that the blue is the hospital and the orange are some medical condominiums that are next door, and then right across the street in that great big parcel are a lot of medical offices, a nursing home, so it had any kind of health screening, since it's related and near the medical facility, that we could get a much, much higher density. So what we ended up building there is Templeton Place, which is a rental complex for seniors, and we actually increased the dwelling units per acre up to 11. We got 29 units before. We probably just got 4 or 5 units. So this is an example of how maybe you could look at some of your zoning. This is something we completed in Santa Maria for farm workers in 1995. It's 65 townhomes. There we have actually 2 parking spaces per unit. And we have a large community center and a daycare center. And we got that density at about almost 16 dwelling units per acre. And the Victoria Hotel is the one we all kind of brag about because it was built in 1925 and downtown Santa Barbara, right near the courthouse. The family that owned it, they'd owned it over 50 years. This was a postcard down on the left that we found in the hotel. So we think that was in about 1940 or 1950 from the car. But it had deteriorated, and it was what they call a single-room occupancy hotel. Upstairs were 30 rooms, and they had been occupied by people on SSI, some seniors, some Vietnam vets. The Victoria hotel was in horrible condition. I mean, the roof was falling in, the plumbing didn't work, the electrical was bad. There were no fire sprinklers, and yet everyone smoked in their room, they cooked in their room. It was just a disaster. So this now, actually, we ended up, that's an error, it should be 28. We have 28 units there. It's a studio and 27 rooms. Some of the rooms have baths, others share. And then every morning we put out breakfast for the people Monday through Friday. And the kitchen we shut down, and then in the afternoon and evenings they can use the microwave and heat up food and use the dining area. And we were able now to provide housing in downtown Santa Barbara, and people are renting this room. And the rent structure runs from $372 a month to about $500. And although that sounds a lot for downtown Santa Barbara, where rents are you know, escalating, it's a lot. And then we have some people on Section 8. But the density there is 121 units to the acre. This is something we did in Morro Bay, finished this in 2000, and it was built as condo style. Those are all very large 3-bedroom apartments. Each one has their own garage, and that density is 17 dwelling units to the acre. This is something we did in Santa Maria back in 1990, and we did 0 lot lines. This is all home ownership. And it works out to a little under 9 units per acre. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of what we do. But what I didn't mention is that parking is such an issue, and especially in places like downtown Santa Barbara. So what they're doing are tents. So what we're doing for people that will get preference to live there is people who do not have a car. The idea being they're building the parking garage to serve the existing parking needs of downtown. But if we give preference to those people that don't have a car, then we don't have to worry about providing a parking space. Also, what they're looking at is open parking lots. I don't know if you have any here in town, but they're looking at those parking lots as a valuable resource and looking at a way to build parking above and housing above. So they're looking at land as a very scarce resource and trying to use it any way they can. And we're looking at a lot of ways to waive parking. Instead of putting 2 spaces per unit, put in maybe 1 and then restrict, which we do, we restrict the occupants only to having 1 car. So if those just give you some ideas on density, they can be attractive and a nice addition to your community. And provide some affordable housing.
So. Can we ask some questions?
Sure.
Does anybody else want to ask any questions?
Are you going to, if we would ask you to build something for us with a amount of rent, $500 a month for a two-bedroom unit. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you can come back and say, we can do that if you do this? Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
The end result is where we want to start.
Right.
If we're going to try and meet some of these mandated housing costs, we have to start with the price and work back to...
And that's exactly what we do. We've already developed price range. I've got the income guidelines. And then the cost that family or that person can afford, we just work backwards. These are the new incomes that have just come out, I believe. San Luis Obispo, a four-person household at 80% of area median is $46,000 a year. So we're really serving families in our ownership between probably $28,000 and $46,000 a year. And in our rental programs, we're serving people that make as little as $12,000 a year up to $30,000 a year in our rental housing, I would say. And so we just look at what can they afford. And it's those kind of rents that you're talking about, $400, $500. I think we've got two very large developments in construction, one in Guadalupe that has 80 townhomes and a large community center, daycare center. And we built three four-bedrooms. And I was looking at the rents because they're going to do a special on Channel 3. They filmed down there last week. And I think the rents are $450 to $6. And those are beautiful townhome rentals. But we had to put together a lot of financing, and that's part of what we do is try to look for funds out there and put together a package. Yeah.
What kind of financial assistance would be an incentive to have you do development marketing?
One of the things in all of these, that's a federal funding program, and the county administers that. We apply for that, and we use home funds. If it's in a redevelopment agency, we've used some redevelopment set-aside funds. In Paso, we've used redevelopment funding in quite a few other places. And then we apply for state funds, and we also know the banks have a special grant program through Federal Home Loan Bank Board that we apply for. But we're at a local level really probably looking at home, CDBG, or redevelopment agency funding. Yes?
Projects where there's commercial and rental.
Right. The hotel has all commercial space on the first floor, and we opened our office there. And we're working on several other mixed use. One of the interesting things that we were asked to do, just gives you an idea, be creative about land. Do you remember the old style Safeway stores that used to kind of look like not a Quonset hut, but then they had parking all around them? Well, in the city of Santa Paula, the Safeway store closed, and a local library was formed. They donated the Safeway store and all the parking lot to a local library. And the library has a literacy program, and they have classrooms, and they're running out of space inside this building. So they approached us and said, is there any way, with all this parking we have all the way around, that you could put some housing in and give us some additional library space? So we started working with them and an architect, and then a neighbor next door who owns a hardware store that faces Main Street came and said, well, you know, my property's right next to the old site. The hotel has three tenants. We have a large, they call it the remnant store, but actually it's big bolts of fabric that interior designers use, so most of the, and it's just packed full, all kinds of interior designers go there to buy fabric. And the other tenant is a corporate office that relocated from Chicago, but they make clothing like Patagonia, if you know what that is. So they have all their designers work in that space. And then when they get ready to do a show or something, they assemble all their stuff. So we have quite a few tenants, and we also rent the basement out. We have an attorney that stores all his files in the basement, and we also have had a couple of bookstores store. So yeah, we do mixed use, definitely. And we've got a couple of others in the works that we're looking at. So Someone else had their hand up, yes.
On your senior housing, I think it's really essential in our area because we do have a high senior population here. I notice you refer to a lot of your lenders or a lot of your money sources as local within the state here. Mm-hmm. Have you ever used the HUD program, the HUD 202 program? As far as seniors goes, is probably one of the outstanding programs
right.
out
the,
there.
The,
and they have specialized lenders like her that lend to people like yourself or other
right.
nonprofit groups that do come in and set up the housing for this for the cities, and they actually go ahead
right.
and manage the program for them.
The development I showed you in Paso Robles, the three-story building with an elevator, that's a HUD 202. And we have HUD 202 in Morro Bay called Ocean View Manor. And we have one in, and they will not give you all the financing that you need to build it. They'll give you about 60 to 70%. You have to raise the other locally. But it is a very good program, and we use it. The senior housing we did on Elm Street, that's a partnership where a large corporation needs tax benefits, and they're willing to invest in a partnership with us to get these tax benefits. But we have to compete for those tax credits annually.
On that Kowalde Court, when I was just visiting one south Elm there,
mm-hmm.
how many units were in that? I couldn't ascertain by looking at that.
Almost 30.
Is there that many units?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't appear to be that from the street.
Yeah, they're all one bedroom. We have, I think, a couple of two bedrooms. That's the partnership that we did with Southern California Edison, and the city of Arroyo has some block grant money in that, as well as some of the county home. So, yes?
Could you explain just, do you have minimum criteria as far as the size of the site that you'd be looking for?
I said to Sue, it's tough, because we also have a development in Arroyo. You know, there's Elm Street, and then the next street to this way is Juniper Street. And right off of Grand on Juniper, we have 12 units and a little small site. And it's really difficult to get all the financing together and make it really work for a small site. But there, again, we had some block grant money to help acquire it, and some home money, and we were able to make it work. But we have 40 units on a site, or very close to one another. Then you can afford to have a full-time manager live there and have a maintenance person and have the community space that we need for the different kinds of support services.
Now you mentioned Valentine Court in Santa Maria, and I happen to know that they had some issues with their funding because they didn't build quite enough density because of Valentine Court. It's kind of situation. Can you maybe kind of give us a feel for what type of densities these the funding sources or the federal grant program that you're using are looking for?
Well, ideally on rental housing, about 18 units to the acre. That's about the bottom line. Valentine Court was unique, and I didn't mention that in my presentation, but the city, we acquired a site, and we figured out how to put 35 units on just a portion of it, and what was left over we deeded back to the city, and then they went through a general plan amendment and put a higher density on that site, and we were able to do a second phase. So you have to be clever sometimes trying to figure out how to use small sites. And so I think we've ended up there with, let's see, 53 on 2 acres, a little over 2 acres. But I think the point is that if it's well-designed and especially well-managed, well-thought-through, high density should not be a problem. It should actually be an asset. I know you're worried about views, and if it helps you a little bit. In Morro Bay, views are a big deal in Morro Bay. All along the coast, views are a big deal. Anyone who has a view of the ocean doesn't want to lose it. So what we tried to do was go above that. You know, Morro Bay has hills kind of. Coastal views are a pretty precious commodity. So, any other questions? I have some brochures. Like, yes.
Of the 30 units per acre, how much square feet are each unit? I mean, what are we talking about between
for example, 18 units and 30 units? How much space are these people getting?
The 18 units per acre, most of those are 2, 3, and 4-bedroom units. And on our rental housing, they have to be at least about 1,000 square feet for the 3-bedroom units. So they're not real small. They're pretty good size. The senior housing, we've been able to have 1-bedroom units at about 500 square feet. So it depends on who you're trying to serve. If you put in smaller units, you can get more density.
But for senior, that's around?
Seniors, 500 to 550. Yes?
I have a question. With some of the higher density products, how do you deal with the association? Are they rentals? Or are they
most of our very high density are rentals. In the single family, home ownership, we've tried to do zero lot lines where it's a small lot. Maybe the front is only 40 feet wide or 37 feet wide. And what you do is you have one side yard setback larger on one side than the other. So there's still room between the houses, but there's...
My question was, is if you have an association, I know you showed a condominium example up there.
But those are rentals.
Okay, those are rentals.
Those are rentals.
So I was wondering how people, if you have an association, how do they afford...
Separate single-family lots, and then we may do attached high density that look like condominiums, but they're actually rental. And we the rental complex pays monthly fees every month, just like the association would. And we have to include that in the rent structure. Yes?
I thought we've heard scare stories of so many problems with getting insurance for condominium projects or rental housing. How do you avoid that?
Well, it's bad right now. Where we're having problems is not so much the funding, but the insurance companies aren't allowing the subcontractors that we use to work on apartments or condominiums. But if they know the apartments are permanently affordable, then they can get insurance. What most of the insurance companies are fearful about is if someone builds a rental apartment complex and 5 years later converts it to condominiums and there are any construction defect lawsuits, they're at risk. So with us, our apartments are always affordable. We've been able to get around that with our subs.
Are these all deed restricted so that
you
are mandated to always provide affordable housing with some percentage of...
Right. All of our rental housing is restricted as affordable for a minimum of 40 years, but most of them 55 years. And as a nonprofit, in these partnerships such as Coelty Court, Southern California Edison is our partner only for so many years and for 10 years. And then when their tax benefits are gone, they leave the partnership and People's Self-Up Housing owns it exclusively. And as a nonprofit, they'll be perpetually affordable.
When the HUD talks to you about housing, they talk about basically building rental units and that.
For the most part, yes. Although they do fund home ownership programs. For example, some of the home ownership programs, like the sweat equity home ownership, some of the down payment assistance that the families get comes from the federal CDBG. Someone qualifies, but they're $25,000. There's a gap of $25,000. We have used CDBG, and we've also used the home program as a down payment for that family. And it carries an interest rate, but they don't make payments on it. And then if they ever sell the house, they have to pay that back. So sometimes federal funds are available for home ownership, too. Yes? Of the development staff peoples, we have between in construction, because we have people out on the sites, between 25 and 30. But in the property management, because we have about 27 properties and we have staff living at every one, we have more, probably about 50 property management staff. My board is made up of all local volunteer type people. And when we wanted to do rental housing, they felt uncomfortable with someone else managing it. And so they made the decision we were going to self-manage, and we were going to manage in such a way that our staff live there and are part of the community and build community. So we have at least two staff on every property. Yes?
Since you deal with so many people in the low to low moderate income bracket, your bonus densities that you were getting through different municipalities were
20 to the acre, and we put in 40, so they gave us 100% density bonus on the whole development. So that's how we look at it. We look at the whole development and ask for either a 25% density bonus or more, if possible.
What about projects that have existing buildings that you come back to refurbish, mm-hmm. and you make modifications? I mean, I know you have a history of asking on those refurbishments for higher densities. When you do that, are you on a percentage base for density bonuses on that type of project?
Well, the ones that we've acquired and completely renovated, those we have usually decreased the density a little bit because we take a couple of the apartments and turn them into community space. So we've acquired in Isla Vista a 58-unit apartment complex, and we created 56 units. So we actually reduced. But in Isla Vista, the density is like 30 or 40 to the acre. If you've ever been to UCSB, you know what it's like. It's real high density. And there we actually took a couple units and created open space. Yes?
On regard to your density matter there, when you're working with the Fed 202 programs and that, do they set the guidelines on the density, or do they accept whatever the local community sets forth as density standards?
Well, what they really want you to do is go to a high density. They're used to high densities, and because it's a competitive process to get their funding, they want to make sure you're not underutilizing the land. And so you have to almost go to higher density just to make it work because, as I said, they don't fund all of it. They'll fund maybe only 70%. It's very competitive. Affordable housing crunch, I'm seeing people roll back. For example, the city of Paso had actually downzoned. Now they're upzoning again because they have their housing element update and they're having problems finding sites. So I think the pendulum swings a couple of ways, and unfortunately we're way over here where prices are so high that the only way you can really build and make it come out is higher density.
And the other part of that is I'm concerned, I understand the concept, but we're not saying there's a maximum. So I don't know if there's any discussion. If you're going to establish a minimum, you do need to maybe set a ceiling, because if you're just saying minimum, are we going to allow someone to go up 100 units right. per acre?
Well, I think you have to be realistic. You can have a range, but for example, the county of San Luis has pretty good densities in their multifamily. We've built in Cambria, we've built in the unincorporated areas. When Paso downzoned to like 8 units to the acre, it just doesn't work in multifamily. So it's much better to be able to have at least 15 or 16 units per acre.
Minimum densities on the population units that corporation builds, you're looking at 50% of maximum as the minimum density for project targeting this median income bracket.
It's just really hard. Land is so expensive, and then when you add the fees on top, I see one developer here. He hasn't said much, but as you add fees and other things, it gets tough. I mean, lumber and stuff, it hasn't gone up proportionately like the cost of land. I mean, if you look at what lumber costs and drywall costs, that it hasn't gone up that much in the last 10 years, but land has doubled, triple, quadrupled. That's really what's made the difference.
Are federal tax credits still available?
They're still available. The way it works is that each state gets so many based on population. And New York and California get the most because they have the most population. And then they're given out twice a year in a competition. And they come through the state treasurer's office. So we compete for those.
But is it true that most of those are given to larger cities because they have a greater volume, greater population?
No, it's on a project basis. Uh-huh, and the way they've done it is they have some allocations, like L.A. County gets so many, and then we're unfortunately in what's called a rural set-aside. So we're kind of in this one pot of money that everybody goes after. But we've been fairly successful every year, at least, at getting them funded.
Thank you.
And they look at local, you get points. If you have local funds, they give you points. If you're close to services, they give you points.
I'm curious, does the state still have a program where they will lend money for a project which is forgivable in 40 years in the event that the project has not been able to pay off the principal and interest?
They don't do that anymore. They want their money back at the end of 40 years. And the way they're working it now is they will loan you the money at a low rate of interest, 3 or 4%. But every year they look at your budgets, and as soon as you can afford to make a payment, they want the payment. So unfortunately, the state isn't giving away money. They want it back.
And then yes. At the end of that finance period, then what happens to the funds?
They go back to the state. They're supposed to put them back out again.
And is some allotted for maintenance and requests after 30 years of the building?
Well, what we do is out of the rents every month, we deposit into what we call a replacement reserve account. Mm-hmm. So when you compete for these funds, you have to put together a 15-year projection on your income and expenses, and you have to show every month how much you're depositing into a reserve account for replacement. Yes?
When your rental units are high-density rental units, are they all required to be, say, for instance, ADA compliant, or a certain percentage of them have to be ADA compliant?
We have to meet the state ADA rule, and then on some of the federal funds, the additional.
Does that appreciably raise the cost of the building on it?
Not that much. I would say a little bit, but not that much. Where it gets expensive is if you have to go to a two-story building and have an elevator. And, you know, we are putting fire sprinklers now in most of all our buildings. And if you have an elevator, we're doing backup generators, and, you know, that it's not just the elevator, but the backup generator that's expensive, too.
Do you have a ballpark number on, you just mentioned the elevator in a two-story building, do you have a ballpark on what that number might be?
Probably 30,000. That's what I would think, 25 to 30,000.
One more question.
Oh, yes, and Ed had one, too. He was so quiet. As a builder, I was surprised he didn't have a lot of questions.
On personal?
Yeah.
Jeanette, you said that basically the nonprofit sector would take care of the units at 80% of median income and below. Uh-huh. And the for-profit sector would take care of the rental needs for 80% of median income and above. Yet the guys that I know that do apartments basically tell me they haven't seen anything pencil in years.
It is true, Ed. I guess where I was going was more the for sale, the home ownership product. And we haven't really tried to serve higher incomes in our home ownership program, although we're getting pushed to do that. We've been asked to look at go up 120% just because of the difference in the what people make versus the cost of housing. But most of the funds that we work with are restricted to 80% and below, so that's kind of where we've stayed.
But the for-profit at the higher densities, it's going to make more sense.
Yes, yes, it will.
But the problem has been most of the communities that downzone, right. Not upzone, like Arroyo. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had property that was, I don't know, one time it was 15 units, then it became 8 units per acre. Mm-hmm.
And it is, we do see more of an interest if people can get density in looking at income property. We are seeing that, and I think some of the tax laws may change to make it more attractive, too. They used to have accelerated depreciation, and they got rid of that, so that comes back. You had one more?
Yeah, as I said, you know, I look at the slides of the wonderful projects you've done in Rio Grande and Paso Robles and Santa Maria. Can't help but be a little envious. So the question is, when do you...
Well, you know, they cornered me. We had a dedication in Oceano because we completed two nice little developments down Oceano, and he cornered me at this dedication and said, okay, when are you going to do something in Grover? And I think what we need to do is sit down with, frankly, what we've done is a window survey. You know, you just have to drive and go and look. And what sort of intrigued me a little bit was the idea of mixed use along Grand Avenue. Maybe something there will pan out in the way of some sites. because I think we're seeing people, I mean, commuting is so expensive, gasoline is so expensive, a payment on a car is expensive, so if people could have nice rental housing close to services, we're finding more and more people like that. They're coming back. For example, I said those little rooms in downtown Santa Barbara, they're only 12 by 12, those rooms in that hotel. Who would think that we would have a downtown worker, and we have a couple of downtown workers, live in a 12 by 12 space and share a bath, but, you know, they don't have to have a car. The public transit is right out there. They can walk to services. So I think you'll see more of that. We'll look.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It was very interesting information and really good questions.
I have some brochures.
That was very provocative and some very fine examples of affordable housing. And I think Jeanette and I will be talking. And the issues she's
it really takes a partnership, and where we've been successful is a partnership between elected officials and the community, because these things aren't easy. It takes a lot of people working them out, so it's exceptional that you guys have such interest. So I'll leave a few extra things.
Well, thank you very much for coming and sharing your information with us tonight.
And it's a small world. I wanted to tell you that the TV person, I kept looking at him, and I guess I knew he and his partner probably 20 years ago in Morro Bay. So.
Well, we have a couple options at this point. We can either wrap up our conversation in our meeting at this now, or we can open up to other issues that you want to see put on in the queue for the issues and options paper for staff to evaluate and assess. Are there other issues that weren't discussed tonight that you want to make sure get on the get in the issues and options paper, or Mike?
Yeah, I don't know if this is an appropriate time or not. Another thought that I had while walking around the neighborhood. So one of the things I guess I wanted to ask you is, with regard to the property that was initially thought to be appropriate for the conference center, is that a done deal, Susan, or is that property open to other applications?
That's a big question. Ron, do you have kind of that one?
Well, let's try. The property is state property. It's in state park system. The coastal plan assumes that it would be a hotel and conference center. The city's general plan assumes that also. The process that we've been going through at this point involves the two concessionaire, the concessionaire that's there, as well as one hotel developer who I guess went through some process with the city at some point, as well as the state government. We are not making a lot of progress in that regard, and I think if you were talking about switching that from a hotel conference center project to, say, a housing project, that there would be significant changes in a number of plans in order to get to that point. And frankly, it's state property. So I suspect something that is recreationally oriented would be more compatible to that.
So then, Ron, along those lines, there be some attractions there to mixed use where we could build a smart community with shops on the bottom floors and then rentals up above them where people who conceivably would run those shops could live. And that would draw, you know, essentially the connection between Grover Beach and the city, or the ocean, if you will, and would still be recreational and would address the complication with our housing as well.
It is a very interesting concept, Mike. I think there would be a number of challenges and hurdles to get there, as there would be to be able to get to a hotel and conference center. the era of what is occurring now for the state fiscally, if there were some linkage between revenue generation from property associated with recreational purposes and, say, the Parks Department, then I suspect that they would be very interested in that. My understanding is that is not the situation now, that the if there is a significant concession revenue, that just goes into the state general fund and the Parks and Rec Department doesn't get credit for that. So at this point, Parks and Rec is looking at what makes sense for ecotourism or...
So the Jeanette who presented tonight seems, you know, she obviously has done mixed use, or, you know, that's what's occurring in Santa
Monica. Would you like to come up here so the crowd can hear you guys? Hear
I'm not afraid they got me on the screen already.
Speaking up would be good.
Okay.
Well, you think if you came closer, Mike, then we could hear you.
But then we have to share, be like singing a duet. It appeared that Jeanette's concept of mixed use, such as was seen in the old hotel down in Santa Barbara, was one application where they were able to generate revenues, as well as to obviously revitalize and maximize the application of land in a certain area. And we've got a completely huge open space that would be open to the conceivable creation of a smart community where we could have, you know, commerce as well as rental units for that area. As I say, that would kind of create the linkage between what is the ocean and the greatest attraction and what is the city, which we don't really have. You know, I was looking at Pismo, which has a great plan but no real opportunity to create anything because it's already built out. And with us, where we don't seem to have a plan, we have phenomenal opportunity. And I was just thinking that, you know, unless this was a done deal, unless the, you know, the iron had been struck and that it was going to be a conference center, which to some extent would not really address either issue that we need, both generational revenue and housing, if that was still an available option, it might be worth pursuing, at least, you know, in the concept with folks like this. So
I think, well, one way to respond to that, Mike, would be to say that with a conference center, with a hotel, that there is a revenue stream that is perhaps much more significant than there would be with a with residential housing, because the transient occupancy tax would be a significant revenue source to the city, to the extent that it did not have some portion of it weren't dedicated to the project, paying off the project itself. And the property tax would, in effect, be a wash with residential. So I think that is one of the attractions of a hotel conference center. Plus, it imports dollars into the community by bringing people from outside of the community who are coming here and spending money not only to stay in the hotel, but also to eat here or to recreate.
Right, but Ron, if I understand correctly, the rooms, let's say, the rooms were to be where the mobile home is. Is that area would be converted, is that right? At least that was the design that I had seen at one point. And the large open area that sits now was to be the convention center. And I guess what I was wondering is, you know, if in fact that area that would be the convention center could become a smart community with combined mixed use of commercial with residences above, that wouldn't be incompatible with a hotel. In fact, it would quite nice in that people would come from, you know, the hotel rooms as well as our own community, as well as hopefully the folks that are heading down to the beach to stop and shop. And so that was the thing, I guess, because when you look at a convention center, typically they don't sell anything. And for a very large period of time, they're not really purveying to anyone because the facility may be, you know, underused.
That's a good...
Can I suggest that the hurdles that Ron's suggesting are land use, ownership, and Coastal Act issues. However, it might not be inconceivable to have some worker housing included as a portion of of the overall development. I mean, as a mitigation measure, for instance, to incorporate some workforce housing for the folks who work there.
Just one other response, and then I'll turn this back over to Susan, and that's the concept that when you have One of the things that happens in the visitor industry is that there's a seasonality to that industry. One of the things that you can help fill rooms up in the off-season is through conventions and meetings of significant size organizations. That off-season is when you can fill your hotel rooms if you have significant meeting space. And that is what is missing in the South County. There's significant meeting space on the other side of the Cuesta Grande, but there isn't really significant meeting space down here. And the only significant location where that might occur that has the kind of amenities would be the site that we're looking at. And I think that's what the plan has been actually for about 101 years now, mm-hmm. from yeah. what I understand.
So. I always thought sclerosis is something that you could always pray for you.
Any other issues you wanted to?
I was the only citizen on the kind of an ad hoc redevelopment agency committee with Peter Keith and Rich Neufeld that looked into this whole convention center idea, working with the state. And I can tell you that there are a lot of good ideas are out there, but the barrier that we bumped up again more than anything else is the purpose of the state parks and recreation. Department is to preserve the environment. That is what their focus is. That's what their mission is. And the idea of developing anything was so far opposed to what they wanted to see happen that when we were talking about the Hotel Convention Center, we had to almost promise that we would do things like reconstruct the original riverbed. We were going to have to build in all kinds of environmentally friendly amenities, that sort of thing. So the idea of building a mixed use, in my limited experience with this, would be such a hard sell for the state that I'm sure that the whole environmental impact is why we don't have a convention center right now. And we had actually made some headway on that. So I hate to be a naysayer, but I thought I'd just share that perspective because I've been there.
Other issues? Got one behind you, and then John.
Okay. Got a question for Ron while he was up there, but he thoroughly got down. In regards to the King project down there on the convention center there, my understanding, I realize it is on state property there. However, does that mean that any bed tax tendered by the hotel would not be going to Grover, be going to the state?
We would
all
go to the city.
We would receive the bid tax, I believe. This could be a very viable asset to our city.
We're the owner, but it's in our jurisdiction.
Also, it's my understanding, if I remember saying, well, we have a service station on the corner down here, and I believe that is in city property, not on state property. It's this side of the creek, I believe. And what's the size of that property there, and what can we do to develop that in conjunction with the hotel?
All of the property is in the city. That is private property. It is on the market at this point. Bob, you know pretty much about the size of it, don't you?
I'm one of my family members has it listed. And if you're interested,
$600,000.
It's owned by Time Warner.
John?
Yeah, I missed the first workshop. I was home.
I was home ill, but, you know, I thought there was great discussion, and I like some of the items that have come up. I do have a couple of suggestions for the issues and options paper, and I'm wondering if you're going to have a section discussing the issue of constraints to condos and other common ownership developments, because I think it is pretty significant where we're, and it's been touched on earlier today. Yeah, the insurance and you know, some things that might be coming down the legislature that might address that. Uh, I'd also, I know we talked about creating an R4 zoning, and I'm wondering if we've even considered maybe establishing a senior overlay so we can specifically target sites and say we want to go R4, or even if we don't go R4, we can say senior housing overlay allowing up to 30 units per acre.
Okay.
And we are going to broaden our incentive section for affordable housing, meaning density bonuses, parking reductions, and anything else that others are doing, so what are opportunities. Great, thank you.
Anyone else? Chuck?
Since you're making a list for next time around here.
And I realize mobile use is a viable concept, but like I pointed out before, we have an elongated block there on Grand Avenue that probably in our lifetimes will never be fully developed, fully commercially. And even when you use the mixed use, you're still going to have units down below that got to be rented out to businesses there. Obviously, the landlord will have no problem renting the residential units above. So I still would like to see designated blocks within the corridor for strictly residential, whether it be senior housing with a high density and built to or designed to fit in with the whole commercial concept of Grand Avenue there. It'll provide definitely more bodies to supplement our business area. And it'll probably be easier to develop a project like that because you can put more units in density-wise, you know, like you said, it's easier to get sometimes better funding if you can provide a more density in these programs.
Steve?
I just had two things. One was just to maybe shed some light on the value of a convention or conference center. Based on my experience in business, and I think Ron might be able to back me up from a BCB perspective, is we really don't have a place. And we're in a strategic location in the state to bring organizations together for meetings or trade shows. When you think about it, we've got the aging facilities in the fairgrounds in Santa Maria. We've got another somewhat aging facility at the Paso Robles Fairgrounds. So I do think it's a...
Hey, baby. I think it's a... that's for my children if they're watching. I think it's a true benefit if we can find something here because there isn't the space anywhere else on the Central Coast to do something like that. The second thing was is we do have some industry professionals that are doing this and are running across these obstacles on a daily basis, perhaps. I'd really like to hear from them. What is it going to take for them to feel comfortable about doing one of these high-density developments? Because I need to know what they need for us to brainstorm and figure out how to provide it to them to make it happen. Otherwise, we're having a lot of workshops. So that's it. Thanks.
Well, I'd suggest the first step in that effort will be the land use inventory. Excuse me. Where we're identifying the vacant and underutilized lots, appropriate places to rezone, different types of zoning, different types of standards. And once we can focus in on that, then we can attract or concurrently talk to them and say, what is it you need? Here's something that might work. What would make it work? Great.
Currently, Susan, are there any plans for any other hotel, motel within this area? Like, for example, the Holiday Inn Express at the top of the hill. Is there anything going on for any other hotel?
I don't have any.
Nothing?
Right now. Got any friends in the hotel industry?
I think that also when we're thinking about this kind of housing where we have the housing above the commercial in Grover, that we can't forget the parking because those commercial structures can never exist. They're going to be competing with their own residents for parking. And they already, because it's a long, narrow strip there, they're already going to have problems flourishing, as we've seen, even in the strip in Oceano coming down to the ramp and everything like that. So unless we have parking available every couple blocks, you know, then there's no way this concept is going to work. It's wonderful to have it, to have worker housing there, and it would be utilized, but those shops have got to make it, or stores, or whatever they are.
We are considering planning a parking district in the downtown area to address parking for these small lots, so hopefully that will help.
I spoke with former planning commissioner this afternoon, Ellis Roth. Most of you probably remember Ellis. And he has some ideas that concern the property west of 4th Street. Most of the homes there are one story. And he's concerned about view sheds and the fight that's going to start with view sheds. And the feeling that part of our community gives us. He wanted to, and I asked him to come here tonight. Basically what he was asking is us to look at our ordinances and see if we can, one, keep all that whole area one story and limit it to, you know, prohibit two-story building there. And he felt that would keep the cost of housing down, because if it gets to be two-story, he feels that it's going to be similar to some of the southern coast down in the L.A. area, and the housing is going to go from what we think is outrageous right now, $500,000 to $1.5 million, once you start putting 25 to 3,000 foot square foot homes on those. So that was something he brought up, to spot zone that whole area to only be one story and keep a sense of what our community is.
Hello. We've got a big task before us. I want to share some information. The only way to really combat the rising prices of housing and stuff is this term market value. The second you start rezoning property and giving more density, it provides more market value. And it's like this perpetual thing that you keep fighting. The landowner will keep raising his price or her price the more you assess value to that property. How do you provide affordable housing when you're combating market value? And the second we start answering those questions, we'll start seeing solutions. I went to a seminar in Monterey. They actually held a competition, something like we can do here too, of course. It was actually sponsored by Hayward Lumber. And a number of people were invited to participate and judge some of the solutions. And what they did is they had several sites throughout Monterey County that they identified as sites. And they actually had landowners donate their land in terms of sites to provide competitions on. And we saw some really unique examples of how to provide affordable housing. Some were high density, some were real rural, but a lot of good thought, a lot of good solutions came out of it. I'm just kind of rambling on and talking, but market value is one thing. Spurring a good design is a must, because out of that, you'll see some wonderful products. You'll see some things of thinking outside the box. And what I'm faced at, I'm an architect, for those of you who don't know me, I find a lot of the rules, the zoning regulations, it causes you to think a certain way and does not allow you to think outside the box. If there's a way you can get into relationships with contractors or developers to help be part of the team, I find out that it's a team effort. It's a team between a designer, a contractor, a builder, a local builder, a financer, whether it's a local bank. It's really a team effort in bringing all the team players together to see what is the problem along the way. I found out that there's a lot of issues regarding deed restrictions when you try and deed restrict properties. And I guess all the funding comes out of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or those two entities. And when you're actually looking for financing for products, if you have 30-year deed restrictions onto them, a lot of lenders will walk away, not even finance the project. So what you're also looking for is local lending for those specific projects.
But I had the privilege of presenting a very unique project a couple weeks ago before the city of Arroyo Grande, and it was all privately financed, how to get people in. The affordable project. And what it did was, is my definition of affordable wasn't the cities or the states or whatever definition. It's the workers here that are living in the community. Can they afford to move in? Can they afford to live? Right now we're faced with people with a median income and the rising price of real estate. Homes are what, $379? People with 10% down, they're paying an excess of $2,000 to $3,000 a month for that home. If you can find someone to come in with a soft second or something like that, that kind of financing program, people can qualify and be getting in those same exact homes for $1,000 a month. And that was one of the opportunities that I presented on this affordable project that I presented a couple weeks ago. And I'd be happy to share those mechanics with anybody who's interested or city agency. I'd love to share that with you on how that can happen.
I have a question for John, and maybe then Ed can maybe jump in on this. And you know, we talk about the fiscalization of land use, and we talk about all of the giveaways and incentives. I'm just curious, can either one of you guys tell me, what does it take to build a no-frills 1,500 to 1,800 square foot home? Let's take out the land value out of the equation. What does it take to build that home, the brick and mortar?
The brick and mortar, it was for the longest time between $55 and $65 a foot, but now today it's about $71 a square foot, just the bricks and the mortars. That's not city fees, that's not street improvements or site development costs or the cost of the land. It is truly the cost of the land that is driving up the home prices and what people are asking for their land. So if we can come to some kind of relationship to, you know, drive the cost of the land down, and I thought of a lot of good ideas. I don't know if you guys want to hear them or not. But I thought one idea was create a new zone. You know, just create a brand new zone that has certain sets of restrictions on them that are incentives to builders, that are also something that can also, as builders build on that, go in a relationship or partnership with the city, and as those properties turn over or sold, the city would get revenues from that back into their affordable fund. There's a lot of things, a lot of opportunities if we can think outside the box.
Yeah, I guess I was just, maybe I didn't artfully say it, but what I'm thinking is if the city had, let's say, 10 acres, and we said, Mr. Builder, I've got 10 acres, you don't have to worry about paying for the land. How much is it going to take for you to build a 1,500 to 1,800 square foot home? I think we want to know what's the bottom line, because if we're being asked to go down this road of forming partnerships, you know, then tell us what it takes to build that home so then we can assess how we need to help you get there.
We used to joke around that if you got the land for free, you still couldn't make it affordable to state guidelines. What Jeanette was talking about, the under 80%. And it's true, if you got the land for free, you still can't make it happen. But using another word in place of affordable, we call attainable, which means somehow, by hook or crook, somebody can get in there and afford to make the monthly payments. Obviously, if the land is thrown in and you're just paying for the building and the interest and whatever transactional costs you have, then you can make it work. I mean, you could probably even make it work for sale housing. But as far as construction costs, I will go with the $65 to $75 a square foot. It doesn't cost what it used to, but nothing else does. But land has been the biggest inflationary thing. And while I have the microphone, I might just get a little plug in here. I truly believe the biggest problem we have in this county is NIMBYism. People move in here, and they all say to the builders, they say, oh, I really like it here. I hope nobody else comes so it never changes. I mean, I've heard that literally hundreds of times. And I've never been rude enough to say to somebody, well, if you didn't come, it wouldn't change. But I will one day, maybe not. But anyways, NIMBYism is really, it's a potent force. I mean, all you have to do is look at the election in Arroyo Grande last November. I mean, you know, it was save the ag. In order to save the ag in Arroyo, you're going to have to tear down a lot of houses. Guys, too. And everybody's always gotten subsidized in the system. And right now, a problem with this, and I'm going to switch over to smart growth now. You get a little stream of consciousness here. Basically, the last poll, the National Association of Home Builders on homeownership, it's about 86% of the people want single-family detached. 86%. That had actually gotten down to 70% maybe 15 years ago, but it's climbed back up to 80%. Now, I had a planning official in the county said, well, 100% of the people would like to drive a Mercedes. And, well, to me, that's not relevant to the discussion. But the fact of the matter is that they aren't 86% are not going to get detached housing. They can get housing with higher density. And design is the key to higher density. It is the absolute key. If it's done well, people aren't going to know what the density is, and they're going to be comfortable. And we do have the opportunity to do that. How many people want to live above stores? That's a real, real special niche. But if you can't afford anything, suddenly that becomes very desirable. So that will solve part of the problem, but not all the problem. The end of my speech.
Could I get a reaction on a concept from you? I'm sorry, no. Dave? Did you want
to? No, I did have to use
it. I'm just throwing this out. I don't know the answer. We have zoning, and I'm going to use Grand Avenue as just an example because it has many zones along its distance through. Were such perks, advantages for anyone desiring to create new housing, such as density bonuses. Perhaps the current zoning allows 2 units or 4 units on the site, but the density bonus would allow an additional 2 units or some formula, all of which would have to be affordable. The density bonus would have to be affordable. Would something of that concept allow for the party not to get an advantage on the increase the price for the sale for development purposes because that party can't get those density bonuses unless they go into affordable? Does that make sense or is it too complicated? Yeah. I'm just saying that right now I might be able to get, in this particular zone, I might be able to get four units under as normal conditions. But there might be certain perks, and among those perks would be density bonus that could only be used for affordable housing. So now I can get 2 more units on there, and I can construct those 2 units perhaps at less than $71 per square foot because I'm dealing in mass here. Would I be able to generate enough rent, income off of those affordable units to make that all worthwhile for you or somebody else as a developer to undertake? Perhaps some of the perks is giving away, abandoning some right of way somewhere. Perhaps it's a special design consideration the Planning Commission would.
Incentive that I was suggesting, which I think Jeanette was also talking about.
Obviously, yes, Bob. When obviously the higher density, then the land cost is allocated over more units. And so you reduce the land cost on your market units, and you have a reduced land cost on your affordable units. And then obviously when you go, say we're going 4 units or 6 units, your example, you've got marginal costing. You already have certain costs in place, like your overhead and supervision probably would not really change. And so you can be more efficient by building more units. You have a bigger piece of land, you can even be more efficient. So the added bonus density obviously does make things more attractive and will help them pencil out. And yes, it's a good idea.
Okay, Thanks. Well, I think this has been really constructive tonight. We've gotten a lot more information. Dave?
I have
one more?
It's been so long. It's been so long enough. Mr. Mack brought up something about how do you avoid speculation in if a developer comes forward, self-help housing, or someone else wants to package a number of parcels together to make the size and then comes to the city for rezoning to make it affordable, is there some way to avoid the speculation from the current property owners, or how do you handle this?
The monies could be used towards purchasing the land costs. She mentioned tax credits. She mentioned the 202 for seniors and various programs. So maybe those are the types of funds that could be addressed to actually address speculation. I'm not sure.
It's zoned commercial now, and there's a project coming forward that might be 30 units per acre residential. Mm-hmm. The value of that land is going to go up a lot if it's rezoned.
True.
And then
we buy it and then
the speculation. Well, that's the way you have to do it. How do you do that?
Exactly.
Right. And I think the idea, too, is that we need to subsidize, find ways to help bring down the land costs, no matter what it is. Another thing I'd like to mention, too, since I've been more of a passive participant here, is although perhaps 86% of the United States would like to have detached single-family housing, they'll also, at least on the Central Coast, they'll live in whatever's built. If we build multifamily housing, if we build townhouses, if we build studios, these will get rented. These will be purchased. I think it's, in our case, a fallacy to think that we only should build single-family homes because that's what's most desirable. That's what they prefer, but I think people will live in whatever we build because there's such a high demand. I thought I would throw that out there. Chuck, and then in, what's your name?
Stephanie.
Stephanie.
The answer to Ekbom's question about how do you control speculation. Most of your city entities that go into affordable housing form some type of housing authority within their city that controls that to prevent speculation. I believe we're Ron Campbell, things like speculation and to maintain an order in your affordable housing there. And one other question I'd like to add if I have a chance. I know we're talking a lot about density up there. We have to also consider another question when you're looking at high density. How is it going to impact on the city services? Because as you increase density, you're going to have more impact on your police department, your fire department, your trash, and that. So we can't just go out and build these things and not take that in consideration. Otherwise, we may end up with more problems than we started with. But I'd like to see if you can put that on your list up there.
In listening to this, I was thinking about John's suggestion of overlay. And if we were to have a commercial zone property and we wanted it to allow it to become a single-family residence, 30 density, then if we had an overlay for that, it's commercial if you do this, but if you do affordable housing, you're allowed to do this only for affordable housing, you know, so that would lie, so otherwise it would still be commercial, you know, there. Also, deed restrictions, I haven't seen that work real well because people don't have the incentive to keep their units up, whether it be, even if they own it, because they can't have the appreciation. And I thought the whole idea of a lot of this affordable housing, especially housing that you can sell, is to give people a start. And once they start and have a home, I saw that happen with Warren Saunders' project there on Farrell Road that the city subsidized. And I put a couple people in there, and that's exactly what happened. They were able to get into it when they couldn't afford anything anywhere else. And they kept it up really nice. They refinanced and paid off the city. So the city got their money back to put into something else. And then they moved on to buy something else and still do well in our community. And I kind of think that's a concept that we should really not lose sight of, because we want everyone to do well and keep going and not have projects. And I would hate to see projects here that become run-down, stigmatized housing. I would rather see people do well. That's it.
Got someone made a comment that I've been talking too much, but I missed the first workshop, so I feel like I got to catch up with everyone. I think Bob touched on a good point earlier in that I think the whole idea behind this density bonus is you leave the base zoning there, so that's the base density, and if someone buys it at that, the builder, whoever buys that, then comes to the city and says, hey, have I got an offer for you? You know, I want to go beyond the 10 units per acre, and I want to go up to 15. And then, obviously, we're negotiating as to these need to be affordable, and we get into some of the incentives. And I think that's kind of the hidden nugget that builders are aware of than just exactly. I think the other part of this issue about speculative council or the Planning Commission has in order to give them some certainty or some assurances, and I think that's something we certainly are going to have to look at. With respect to changing zoning and general plan, that's a legislative action that the citizens can get involved with, even if the council approves it. And so those are, it's a lot more complicated than we're able to really go into tonight, but I just wanted to throw those out there so we're all thinking about it.
Thank you. Well, if there aren't any more comments, suggestions, ideas, or items to discuss tonight, perhaps we can wrap it up. If you want to provide any written comments, you can give those to me anytime, email, phone, snail mail. And our next meeting is going to be April 16th, 6:30, City Council Chambers. And we look forward to seeing you all there and anybody else who couldn't make it tonight. Thank you.
Thanks.